Good morning. Afternoon, whatever. I'm wearing my big boy clothes today, as one of my colleagues says. Just pretending to be a grown-up. Won't last long. But I thought if I wore a tie, I should let you see it, so you know I own one. Or two. Okay. The handouts from last Monday are here if you didn't get one on abuse in relationships. The old papers are there if you haven't picked yours up. Are there questions? The distribution on the wall is the total number of points so far, and that reflects everybody who has passed the ECO exam. So if you have not yet passed it, you don't have points for that, so your score is lower than it will be when you pass the ECO exam tomorrow or Friday or whenever you're going to pass it. The second time you take it, if you pass it, you get 40 minus the number of points off. So if you miss three, you get 37 points, and those would be up there. Does that reflect today's or yesterday's? Okay, doesn't reflect today's. Okay. Other, Jill.
Is it possible for you to do that on the website?
I don't know. Theoretically, I'm not rejecting the question or making fun of it. I'm acknowledging my own limited skills. Theoretically, I can put that up because I have the electronic version. I think I can put it up. Yes. I'm not going to spend more than an hour trying to put it up, but I will try to do that. But I think I'll wait until after everyone has taken the ECO exam the second time, so it'll be a little more complete. Yes, the first time is 50 minus the ones that you missed. I don't think either of us has a clue what the highest possible. The highest anybody has is 92. But I'd have to go back through all the exercises and add up all the possible. So anyway, the people with 92 points, or the person with 92 points, is doing A work. Okay. I don't grade. I mean, those are just the points that people have accumulated, and there are people on the roster who only have 4 points. They may have done the first exercise. This is total points so far. Total points so far. I'm assuming that the people who have 2 or 3 points are no longer with us. In the course, anyway. I mean, they may be doing fine, but they're probably not in the course. And if they are, they're not coming to class. And they need to see one of us real soon. Okay. But most people have done lots of work and have, as you can see, it's a pretty skewed distribution. It's way up there. And that's the way the course is designed, so that you can get a lot of points, and you just have to do the work and do it reasonably well, and that's what people are doing. Does that answer it? No. The question is, when are the optional exercises? And actually, that is a an error on the syllabus because we haven't. That was a leftover from last year, and we dropped, I dropped the exercise that was optional this year and forgot to go back and take the word optional off the syllabus. So, I'm sorry. What happened last year was that we had an optional exercise that was worth quite a few points, and people figured out that, well, it wasn't really optional if they weren't going to get the points for it. And lots of people did it, and if you didn't, you were going to drop way down in the distribution, so that didn't, it was confusing. So we dropped it. Okay, other questions? All right, I want to talk briefly about the readings, of which you have a number, and you've probably found them on the library website, Electronic Reserve. And I want to make a couple of comments about those in response to questions that I have just been forgetting to answer. I haven't neglected them, I just keep forgetting to answer it. The first is that there is a little detective work that you have to do in order to find the readings on the library website. The problem is that what I gave you and what is on the schedule for reading is the authors. Because everybody in the world does their bibliographies, author first and then the title. Everybody in the world except the Bailey Howe Electronic Reserve System, which has them listed by title. So you have to do the extra step, I'm sorry, and I've asked them about changing it, and they say, not in this decade, because of the software limitation. Anyway, what they have is, what you have on the schedule is a reading by Strauss. You have to go to the bibliography in the syllabus to see that the title of the reading by Strauss is, I don't know, something about spanking. Then you have to go to the library website, skim down, and it won't say Strauss, it'll say something about spanking. So it's just a little extra piece, you have to put it together. The reserve librarian thought that they might be able to change it, and then he kicked the question to the software people, and the software people laughed and said, no way. But I am going to try and experiment next year, because I think I have figured out how to game the system. I have figured out that the electronic submission of the reserve stuff is up to me. And where it says title, which is what it says title, and then it says author and all that sort of stuff. But what shows up on the website as you get it is the list of titles. I think I can type the author's name. And then the title, and I think the computer won't figure out that I've actually typed a name rather than a title, and I think it will print what I put on and list them in alphabetical order as they are in the syllabus. So I'm going to try that. Stick around for next fall and just check, see if it works for me. I think there's a workaround, and I think that's it. Haven't checked with any hackers yet, but we'll see. Okay, that's the first thing I wanted to say. You have to do some detective work to get at the readings. They all should show up. You click on them, and it should download it automatically to your computer. You are aware that when that happens, some of you have to instruct your computer to download it. Some of us don't. It just, there it is. If you have a slow landline, this will tie up your computer for large amounts of time, potentially. And if your computer is full, you won't get them. You'll freeze up your computer, especially if you're using a PC. So you need to make sure that you have room and a place to download them to in order to get them. You can view them and then delete them. You can download them, carry them around the rest of the semester, and never read them. That's your option. You can sleep with your computer and hope that they come through. I recommend reading them. So the question is, how should you read them? I will not ask lots of picky questions about the readings. They are, some of them, classic readings. They are important essays or data or research studies that, if you're going to understand families as a context for development, you need to have some understanding of. I'm not going to get into picky questions about them. Most of them are an opportunity for you to try translating the reading into Bronfenbrennerese. Okay? So what I'd like you to do is, when you read Strauss's article on more reasons why spanking doesn't work, I would like you to think about the parent-child relationship and how Bronfenbrenner would talk about spanking. And if you can think about why not spanking, and using some of the techniques that Strauss refers to in the article, why that is better developmentally than spanking would be. What are the limitations of spanking? If you're reading, for example, Pepper Schwartz's article on love is not enough, what you need to have a good relationship, or what happy couples think they have, translate that into dyadic relationship terms. And what she's giving you is examples of high reciprocity in a relationship. She's giving you equal balance of power. She's giving you how you actually demonstrate positive affect. She doesn't say that, but I want you to understand what she's saying about couples, happy ones and unhappy ones, and explain it using the developmental concepts. And if you can do that, then you have enough understanding of the reading to answer any questions that I am likely to ask you about it. Okay. So you don't need all the minor detail, but you should work on each reading. Okay. It is not sufficient to open it up, skim it, and say, okay, that one's about relationships. How is it about relationships? And how does it connect to what we're studying? How does it connect to developmentology? So you need to do the work to translate the reading, make sure you understand it, make sure you can apply a developmental perspective to making sense out of it. And yes, there will be question or questions about all of them on the final exam. So I don't assign anything I don't ask you to be able to respond in some way to the exam, but they will not be tiny, tiny, picky questions. They'll be central concept questions. Okay? I've checked them all out. They are all complete. We had to rescan a couple of them. I think you shouldn't have any trouble accessing any of the readings. If you do, please email me immediately and let me know, and we'll see if we can sort it out. But generally, they're in very good shape. All the copies now are legible, all the electronic copies. So this is good. Okay, questions about the readings? We talked about assignment 5, which is due in a couple of weeks. 3 weeks? Yeah, long time from now. Don't worry about it till then. Okay. Anything else? Okay, we talked about cohabitation, we talked about breaking up. What would you want to talk about? Let's talk about one of our favorite molar activities today. You like molar activities? Okay, so no, we're not going to talk about sex. We're going to talk about the other one. Argument. Okay? We're going to talk about argument as a molar activity, the joint activity. And argument is lots of fun. Argument begins with a disagreement about your view of the world, your expectations for each other, or whatever else. Okay? So argument begins in development. Development is constructing a valid and differentiated view of the world that you live in, right? So if you have different views about that world, whether the toothpaste tube should be squeezed from the middle or the bottom or the top, whether the cap should be findable and replaced, whether you should use my toothbrush or not, how often we should have sex, how we should have sex, what we should do about contraception, how we spend our money. Those are all issues about differences in views of the world. Okay? So your view of the world and your expectations are one of the favorite beginning places for argument. So it's an important part. Does it have meaning if you argue? Usually. Some of us argue for the sake of arguing, and then it's an important molar activity. Okay? Because we like to do it. We join the debate team. We become lawyers. We become orators. We become teachers. Does it have intent? Yes. If the difference is important, you want to resolve it. And that's the intent. For some of us, you resolve it by, by stepping off the step and breaking your neck. I hope somebody's prepared to continue the lecture. The notes are down there. I better just... Okay. So for some of us, the resolution of an argument is achieved by winning, by convincing the other person to share your view. Okay. For others, resolution means compromising, come to some middle ground. For some of us, resolving an argument means ignoring it, making it go away, forgetting it, and never bringing the subject up again, so we won't be aware that we view the world differently. Okay. So we want to ignore this. And many of us learn that early on in life, that when you have a difference of opinion or view, don't bring it up, don't talk about it, it'll destroy the relationship, and you don't want to do that. So we learn not to discuss the differences in our opinion. So our intents in having arguments and our views of how important arguments are differ. Does it have momentum? Well, yes. People stay in it until it's resolved satisfactorily. Now, that may not be an active process of staying in it. For many of us, when we're arguing and we can't control this and we're feeling out of control, we move to the, okay, let's ignore it. We don't want to talk about this anymore. Let's bury it. But for the couple, it remains underground, undiscussed, and then we deal with it indirectly. So the difference is there. We're not discussing it, but we have to deal with the difference. We have to deal with it some way. So, what are the options? What do you do when you know there's a difference of opinion, you know it's important to you, but you can't discuss it? What do you do with it? What did you see your parents do with it? What do you do in your own relationships? There's a difference. We know it's there. It's not safe to talk about it. What do we do? None of you do this. You
allude to it.
You allude to it. You allude to it. Do you understand what that means? You refer to it obliquely, not directly. You kind of bring it up symbolically. You kind of throw a I like the fly fishing analogy for alluding to it. You throw the fly out there and see if it comes, see if it gets a bite. And if it doesn't, you reel it in and you throw it out a few weeks later. So it's there. You're testing the waters. Can we have this discussion? And if you're the one who's more comfortable discussing, that's one of the ways you may do it. You can allude to the difference of opinion in other ways that are less respectful. You can indirectly remind the other person that she's an idiot because she doesn't agree with you on this. You can't discuss it, but anybody who feels this way, votes Republican or Green Party or whatever, is obviously an idiot, and indirectly you're criticizing the person who has a different view. Okay? So it's there and you keep coming back to it, but it never really gets addressed directly. What are some of the other ways you deal with that under the table argument? Louder, I'm okay. So you bring people in on your side to strengthen it without actually talking about the issue. You triangulate, you bring people in on your side against the person who's different, and you talk to them about their view, usually within hearing of the person who won't bring it up, so that they understand that they're in the minority now because you brought in reinforcements. Right, so it's a variation on the triangulation theme. You bring in the reinforcements and you let them do the confrontation. They know that it's too tricky for you to do it, there may be too much of a blow-up, but you recruit them so they'll have the discussion about the difference. Okay. Underhanded, manipulative, I like it. Other ways you have seen people deal with the problem that doesn't get resolved? Some of the classic ways are you just keep ignoring it. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it becomes the elephant in the living room that nobody notices because it's there, but everybody knows it's there, and there it is. The elephant in the room that everybody is ignoring and walking around, but nobody's going to address it because they can't bring it up. It's not safe to bring it up. Another way people deal with that underlying problem is to take a little bit of the credibility and respect for the other person away. Okay? If somebody disagrees with you and they can't talk about it, and they make it unsafe for you to talk about it, then your respect for them, your esteem for them goes, eh. And it adds to your disrespect. It decreases the respect within the relationship. And later today we'll talk about how important disrespect is in ending a relationship. And one of the logs on the fire of disrespect, I don't know, chase that metaphor if you want, I'm not going to pursue it. But one of the things that fuels our disrespect for people is knowing that they disagree with us and that we can't have a reasonable discussion about it. Yeah. So what we do with that is as our respect for them declines, we begin to criticize them for other things. And then we have the beginning of the decline into breaking up. in the relationship. So the argument, the difference that is not discussed, is continuing potentially to be destructive to the relationship. Respectful relationships are based on dealing with the disagreements that may come up. Some couples don't have a lot of disagreements because their views of the world are very similar. And they don't have fights or arguments because they just put their disagreements out on the table and say, well, gee, we found another disagreement. I'm close to one couple who've not had a fight in 7 or 8 years. They've never had a fight. And they're happily married. And people say, well, gee, and they say, well, it's because we're still on our honeymoon. The honeymoon ends when we have our first fight, but they know how they're going to deal with the first fight. And they've got it all planned out. In the middle of the fight, when voices get raised and they're getting angry with each other, which hasn't happened yet, one of them is going to notice that they are having their first fight. Aha! We're having our first fight! Oh, great! The honeymoon's over. We can start the marriage now. And then they're going to break out the champagne, which has been on ice. It's getting really aged at this point. It's probably gone by. I suggested to them at one point that they take the champagne out once a year on their anniversary and drink it and put a new bottle in so it wouldn't get too old. I don't know if they're doing that or not. So they're going to drink the champagne, and then they're going to resolve the argument, and they already know how they're going to resolve it. No, they're not going to jump into bed immediately. They will actually resolve the argument in the best possible way. He will say, you're right. Okay. This is the best possible way to resolve an argument in a heterosexual relationship. He just says, you're right, I agree. It was stupid of me to differ. And you know, he's developing because he's developing a more valid view of the world. By agreeing with her view, it's more valid. Okay. And they will probably do that, and may they someday get to drink the bottle of champagne. But for many of us, what happens is the argument is there, it gets bigger and bigger, and it decreases our ability to have fun and to enjoy each other and to build our respect because the disagreement is there and not resolved. So couples who have good conflict resolution or difference discussion skills are able to put the difference out on the table, discuss it, figure out how to live with the difference, which is what many of us do in good relationships. Here's the difference. I understand how you got your view. It's not the same as mine, but it's an interesting view, and we can talk about it, and maybe someday I'll come to my senses and agree with you, but right now I differ. So we're not going to do that. One more strategy that often happens is that the disagreement, which is growing into an elephant, is also festering. So it's going to become a fetid elephant. It's going to become the rotten elephant in the living room. And while it's becoming the rotten elephant in the living room, it's going to make people unhappy, and they're going to fight about other things. So instead of having the fight about what needs to be fought about, they're going to have little fights. They're going to start to pick at each other. They're going to complain about things that aren't important. They're going to escalate those little things into big fetid elephants. And they're going to do that until they break up, never having resolved the argument, the original one. They're going to go into couples counseling, and the couples counselor is going to say, I don't understand quite why you keep having this argument about the toothpaste tube, or whatever it is. I'm wondering if there is something older and deeper that perhaps you disagree on. And if they've talked and they don't take that bait and start talking about it, then the therapist is going to say, I've been enjoying your company for 3 or 4 months. You don't seem to have any major disagreements, but you don't get along. I'm wondering if there's an elephant in your living room. And if the therapist is really intuitive, I was going to say, so what are the disagreements about alcohol use? What are the disagreements about sex? What are the disagreements about money? You get to the big three or four, and eventually you'll get to the argument. And that's the value of counselors. They don't let you ignore the elephants. They also create a safe place for you to discuss the disagreements. And they may even teach you discussion techniques. So people will stay in the argument until it's resolved, even if they're not arguing. It's going to stay there. And it will continue to interfere with the couple's relationship until they figure it out. Molar activities get more complex. Can arguments get more complex? Of course they do. Some of them get really complex. You start off arguing about the toothpaste tube, and then you end up talking about her cooking and his money and the kitchen sink and the state of the garage and his ridiculous whatever. And we call those kitchen sink arguments because they pull everything else in to the argument, including the kitchen sink, and lose the focus on what it was that they started with that is really the issue. And they do that because they're trying to heighten the difference and gather ammunition. So the arguments become more complex and more chaotic is another way to say that, because people are bringing in everything you've ever done wrong to put you down because you disagree, and none of that helps resolve the argument. It escalates it. And arguments can become more complex by becoming manipulative and bullying and violent, all that kind of stuff that keeps couples from resolving the argument, because it's very difficult to resolve an argument when somebody is blaming you for the state of the world and reminding you of everything you have ever done in your life that was wrong. As an aside, some of you have parents who remind you of all the stupid things you've done. I hope you don't, but some of you do. And so if you disagree with them, they remind you of what you did 10 years ago. This is not a good relationship technique. I was in a workshop, this is completely aside, but just a little echo autobiography for me. I was in a workshop on fathers a number of years ago, and we were encouraged to think about what we remembered about our fathers. And of course, most people in the workshop turned out to be thinking about negative things. And I realized for the very first time, I was able to articulate that one of the things I really liked about my father was that he never ever reminded me of something stupid that I had done. He never reminded me. He dealt with whatever stupid thing I had done, and I did a couple. So he had lots of practice. We resolved it. I took whatever punishment was there, or he bailed me out, and I thanked him. And we went on. And as I thought about it, I realized he never, ever, to me, brought any of those up. He never reminded me of any stupid thing that I had done. He's always focused on the things that he appreciated and liked. And to my knowledge, and this is parenting advice, to my knowledge, he never entertained his friends by telling them about the stupid things that any of us, his children, had done. Wow! What a gift! He may have done it, I don't know, but he never did it in front of me. He never embarrassed me in front of family, friends, or his acquaintances by telling them stupid things I had done. And I've watched other people not do that. I've been entertained by parents telling me in front of their kids the stupid things that the kids had done and how inadequate they were and how much... And I realized that I was given this tremendous gift by my both parents, but particularly by my father. Now, having said that, back to the lecture, One of the important gifts you can contribute to a relationship, any kind of transaction, is sticking to the present situation, the present disagreement, and forgetting about all the past ones. Kitchen sink arguments are destructive to the relationship. So don't have them. Talk about how you disagree now. You can talk about how you got there and why your views of the world are different. You can talk about how you might resolve it. But you don't need to put the other person down by having the kitchen sink argument. You don't need to prove the other person to be totally incompetent as a human being by reciting all of his or her faults. That's not going to resolve the current argument. So, one of the first rules of argument and fighting is to stick to the current argument. Nothing else. Stick to that. And be respectful of the other person as you discuss your disagreement. It can get more complex. It can get more reciprocal. Yes? It can also get more positive. Okay. If you're going to move toward resolution, you're trying, if you're arguing well, you're trying to understand what it is you disagree on. And to do that, it helps if you can articulate your own view. So you have a view of the world. You need to be able to put that out in an articulate way that takes full responsibility for it. Well, my expectation is that. What is your expectation? And learn the other person's view without judging it. Okay, just here's how you see the world. Okay, I need to understand this. I need to understand what it is you really believe and think, and we can talk about how those views are different, and then I need to make my view more differentiated. I need to understand why somebody that I love has come to the view that she has. So I need to understand both views. And I can only do that if I listen. I can only do that if I want to understand the other person's view. If I don't understand the other person's view, how can I possibly agree with it? Let me give you an example of that. It's really fun talking with couples. I hope you do it a lot, talking with couples about what they do. This one, this couple had an argument that lasted 2 or 3 days shortly after they got married, and I think one of them was having some concerns about whether she should have married this idiot. But this was the argument. After you take a shower, how do you leave the curtain? He said, open. She said, but you didn't leave it open. He said, yes, I did. Okay, now we have a question about what he did. Okay. I left the curtain open. She said, no, you didn't. It will mold that way. Okay. It turns out that they were using the word open differently. Okay. It took about 25 minutes. And we ended up drawing it. What do you mean? Okay. There's the tub enclosure. There's the shower curtain. Okay. How do you leave it if you leave it open? It turned out that one of them thought leaving the shower curtain open meant leaving this opening open. The other thought You open a curtain fully by extending it and covering the opening. They're both talking about leaving the curtain open, but one of them is really referring to leaving the tub open. The other is talking about leaving the shower curtain open as opposed to folded back. It was one of the most wonderful semantic arguments I've ever run into, and they had come to tears about the fact that they were disagreeing about how to do this when in fact they really had the same view, but their language was different. It was absolutely fascinating. And what was interesting as they talked about it was that they had missed that step of trying to understand what the other person really meant. So one of the things that I do with people who are disagreeing is saying, well, you know, show me what you want. And if they had done that in the bathroom as they were crying, said, show me how you want me to do it, they would have resolved that very quickly, because they would have realized that it was the language, not the shower curtain, that was the problem. Okay. So you have to understand what the other person means and question your assumptions about what the other person means in order to resolve an argument. Understand what the other person really means and what the implications of that would be, and then you can figure out if there is, in fact, disagreement. And often there will be. I'm not suggesting that arguments aren't real. I'm suggesting that differences of opinion require that you take a reciprocal view. If you want the other person to listen to you and understand your viewpoint, you have the obligation to put your view out. And you have the obligation to listen to and make sure you understand the other person's point of view before you reject it or criticize. And you have to do that as equals. So the power is equally balanced. So argument is a molar activity. You can do it really well and very skillfully, or you can not do it very well. It helps if you go back to the transactional assumptions. This is a relationship is a transaction. People have different views, and you can address it as a molar activity that you need to learn to do jointly, like playing tennis. Do you enjoy playing tennis with somebody who doesn't play it well, as well as you do? Do you enjoy playing tennis with somebody who always stomps you? No, you want relative balance. So you want to work together to bring each of you to the point where you can have the arguments in an equal and balanced and reciprocal way. Transactional assumption. What is going on here in the cycle, the interaction between us? What am I doing, and what can I do to change myself? And what is going wrong in the relationship? Not what is the other person doing wrong, but what do I want the other person to do? I want the other person to stand up for herself, articulate her view, tell me when I'm not listening. And my behavior might be changed so that we can have arguments more skillfully and actually resolve them. And as we do that, we make our argument skills better. But we also strengthen the relationship, because as you resolve arguments as equals, you build a relationship. It's an accomplishment to take a major difference of opinion and come to agreement on it and figure out how to deal with the difference. That builds relationship. You respect each other more, and you get more comfortable with the fact that, hey, a minor disagreement is not going to destroy this relationship. We have conflict resolution skills, and we can practice those, we can employ those, and we're committed to the relationship, and that means discussing and figuring out what to do about the differences. It may mean that you have to teach the other person what will be good for you. There's a wonderful phrase that I learned a number of years ago, and I can assure you from personal experience, this is a really powerful phrase. When somebody is yelling at you and calling you names in a relationship, or they don't have to be yelling at you, they're being disrespectful, you just remind them gently, this is the phrase, it's really a whole sentence. Would you please talk to me as if I were somebody you loved? You can feel that in your gut, can't you? What does that do in the middle of a disagreement and an argument? Okay. Would you please talk to me as if I were somebody you loved? It works with children and parents, teenagers and parents, lovers, partners. It's actually the name of a workshop that was published. That's where I ran into it. Just talk to me as if I were somebody you love. One of the other techniques that's very useful in building relationship is after you have done something really stupid and one of you has stormed out or ended the relationship, thrown the ring in his face, whatever it is that you do, at some point in the disagreement, it's very helpful, and I recommend you try this. When you realize, this is not what I want, this is not working, you can actually stop and say that in the middle of a conflict. Okay. If it's somebody that you know isn't going to hit you, you can simply stop. Wait a minute, stop. Excuse me. I don't like what's happening. I need to figure out what we can do that's different. Okay. Can we stop? Can we go back? Eventually, can we figure out how we got to where we are and figure out what we could have done differently? Because I don't want to do this anymore. I have a friend who's been a friend for a long time. She has a wonderful technique, and I pass this on to you because it works really wonderfully well. She'll be in the middle of a heated discussion with somebody, and she does this. She says, wait a minute. I need some time to myself. And she literally covers her eyes, covers her face, doesn't respond, and gathers her thoughts. She centers herself again. And then she can say, okay, I'm ready. Now what was it you were saying? And now she's thought about what she wants to say, and she comes back to it with a completely different energy. And it's just interrupting the bad stuff that's going on by saying, I need time to think. I need time to myself. Stop. And it works really well because you really can't talk to somebody who's not looking at you and doesn't want you to talk right then. So that's an important technique. Another technique is, as I said, after things have really gotten out of hand and one of you has stomped out, we call it the post-mortem, the autopsy. The autopsy. The argument autopsy. Okay, this was a disaster. Why? What happened? Where did we get off track? Okay. You both have to agree that you want to do the autopsy. You can call it that. Okay, we killed our relationship yesterday or this morning or tonight. Can we figure out how we got there? And then you take as the new molar activity, analyzing the conflict and the sequence of things that were said, and see if you can reframe it. So you do the autopsy and figure out the cause of death, and then, fortunately, in many cases, you have the opportunity to resuscitate the relationship by going back to the beginning. And as you walk through what he said, she said, what I said, what you said, when you said that, I felt, and because I didn't feel good about that, I said, and that really wasn't a very good thing for me to say, was it? you usually get agreement. And then you say, what do you wish I had said when you said, hmm? And then you get the other person, what would have been helpful to that for you to say to that person at that time. So you can try that one out. Oh, okay, and if I had said that, then what would have happened? And you can write a new script for the discussion, and it becomes a discussion rather than an argument. But you have to be willing to listen. You have to be interested in the sequence of steps that led you to disaster. It's the same thing the Federal Transportation Safety Board does, right? The plane crashed. The train had a derailment. They come in and they figure out what happened. Now they, unfortunately, don't have the opportunity to undo it. But they can make sure it doesn't happen again to the extent that they can do that. A couple in a relationship, parents and children, have the opportunity to go back and start the discussion and do it better. And perhaps get to the resolution of the issue. But you have to agree that you want to understand how you blew it. You have to be willing to take responsibility for the fact that you blew it. Your contribution to the transaction was not as good as it could have been. The other person's may not have been. And you may have thought about the time you started that you really wish the other person had said something different. You need the other person to understand why you blew up when you did. Because you don't want to do that again. It makes you look incompetent. It makes you look predictably unpredictable. It makes you look unsafe. So you want the other person to understand how you think and how you feel so you can figure out a way to have the disagreement without having the blow up. That's the autopsy. Can you do these things? Right, of course you can. Do you do them in a relationship? You do. You use your very best skills, and if you are initiating a relationship, if you are interested in growing up and growing this relationship and learning what you can in it, you agree at the beginning or sometime after your first fight, you agree that you want to learn in this relationship how to resolve differences. And you can say, hey, my last three relationships blew up because I don't know how to have an argument without blowing my stack. So I would like to do better this time around because I like you and I would like to be in a relationship with you. So this time around, would you help me learn to have a difference of opinion without destroying this relationship? You can agree as a couple to help each other. And if you do that, you put that out on the table, we are both going to learn to be better human beings in this relationship by helping each other. Then, when you do have a blow-up, you do have a conflict, part of the post-mortem can be, oh, wait a minute, I need for you to tell me what I did wrong because that's how I'm going to learn. I need for you to process this with me because that's a commitment I have in having a relationship with you or with anybody else. Okay. So you can make that part of your relationship. It's part of the discussion of your expectations for the relationship. What makes a good relationship? How do you get there? Well, Pepper Schwartz says love is not, in fact, all you need. So let's look at what she says. This is from her article. And what she did was ask lots of couples, happy ones and unhappy ones, to describe what their couple relationship was like. And it's very straightforward. If you look at the happy couples, these are the things that they feel. It's on the website, I'm pretty sure. They feel this about their partner and their relationship, and these are things that unhappy couples do not agree is part of their relationship. So, my partner's a very good listener. That's really helpful. We have a good balance of leisure time spent together and separately. In other words, we are not joined at the hip. The Velcro will release if we want to spend time apart. And in happy couples, the autonomy is balanced with the togetherness, the connection. All of us need both. And in the happy couples, they feel they have that balance. The unhappy couples don't. They either spend too much time together or too much time apart. We find it easy to think of things to do together. Aha. Does that qualify as developmental status? The complexity and variety of things that you do on your own? Does it qualify if you're thinking of things to do with your couple? I suppose it's the developmental status of the couple. Together, they can think of things to do. Okay, so they are a developmentally well-developed couple as opposed to well-developed individuals. They may be that too, but they think of things they can do together and they enjoy doing them. They talk to each other in a way that is satisfying to both of them. That's likely to mean reciprocity. It's likely to mean high affect, positive affect. It's likely to mean he's a good listener and we talk to each other. We're creative in how we handle our differences. I'm not sure what they mean by creative, but at least they're happy about the fact that they resolve their differences in ways that demonstrate their intelligence, their emotional intelligence. Financial decisions are not difficult. Sexual relationship is satisfying and fulfilling. We are both equally willing to make adjustments in the relationship. Aha! They both are flexible. They can change. And they're both willing to do that in order to have the relationship. I can share feelings and ideas with my partner during disagreements. In other words, even though we're disagreeing, my partner is able to listen and to try to understand. And my partner does understand my opinions and ideas. What the unhappy couples agree on? There's only one. My partner does not understand how I feel. My partner does not understand how I feel. And their partner is not a good listener. All of those other things. What do you want in a relationship? You want to be understood. You want the other person to know how you feel, to empathize with that, to be able to help you, support you, not put you down because of how you feel. You want to be able to express your opinions and ideas and your feelings even if there's a disagreement going on. You want emotional maturity. And unhappy couples don't have that. So if you want to destroy the relationship, refuse to understand how your partner feels, and it'll happen. You'll be unhappy even if you are still in the relationship, and your partner will be unhappy. So you've got this happy relationship. So let's get married. It's a happy relationship. You've got all of those things going on. So you make the big leap. Some of us do, some of us can. Maybe it's a civil union instead of a marriage. And why would you want to do that? Why would you want to get married? You're in a good relationship, you're cohabiting, you're paying your bills. Why would you want to get married? How many of you are married? It's you and me, kid. Okay. One person. That's it? Just Colleen? And me. Why did we get married?
Because we wanted to share our lives with someone.
We wanted to share, but you're already cohabiting. No, you weren't. No, I wouldn't have if it were not an agreed upon step toward marriage. Okay. Right, what you just heard is 100% you did not cohabit. Okay. I would not have cohabited without knowing that it was going on to marriage. Why not? Other than that it would be living in sin. I mean, that we just assume, but... Yeah, you wanted that connection that would last throughout life, and the marriage ceremony and the commitment that underlies that implies that commitment till death do us part. And homicide is, you know, thou shalt not kill. So we're going to live together. I wouldn't do it because I was unwilling to give up my autonomy and share my space and my toys with somebody that I was not already committed to sharing my life with. Okay. And that's a very simple, straightforward. I couldn't have done that. I couldn't have. And I'm talking about when I was in my 40s. I didn't the first time around because we didn't know about cohabitation. You had to get married. To have sex, you had to get married. So that was back in the old days. But in my 40s, I wouldn't cohabit because I didn't want to complicate my life and share space and create a microsystem with somebody that I was not, in fact, committed to spending the rest of my life with. So, I didn't. All right, so we didn't. So we were looking for commitment and the intent to share the rest of your life with the other person. So why would you want to get married? That's why we got married. I mean, not to each other, but... How many of you expect to get married someday? How many of you want to get married someday? Why? You too?
We made a pact freshman year.
Okay, you're not going?
A certain age, you
okay.
Can't
okay. You can't marry before when? 32?
35.
35, okay. They're not getting married before 35. But you will. We're not going into their personal life. We don't want to punish them for sitting close to the front. Why do you want to get married? Why not just cohabit? Your grandparents are much happier if you're married.
My parents said that they got married.
Yeah. Okay. So parenting, creating a family, becoming parents is somehow easier if you are married. Is that because the sperm and ovum understand?
Just
the social context. Okay. So marriage includes some kind of social recognition of the legitimacy of your relationship for raising children. In the back. Yep. Marriage implies to most people that you are, in the words of some ceremonies, forsaking all others. Forsaking all others. I love the phrase. It means you are not going to sleep with anybody else or have sex with anybody else for the rest of your life. Wow! And some people want, particularly if they're going to have children, they would like that promise on the part of the other person. Doesn't mean you have to have it, but some people would like to know that this is a commitment to monogamy so that we can stop worrying about STDs, so that I know you're coming home at night, so that I don't have to worry about who I'm going to sleep with, I don't have to go out to bars and find somebody because you're going to be there and be available and committed to continuing a sexual relationship with me until we're both 97.
Other than the fact that I have this dog, I
Exactly. The point is that financially, marriage bestows upon both members of the couple a variety of rights and obligations that are legal. They are sanctioned in the law. One of the things that we don't often think about is that there are actually several aspects to marriage. One of them is the relationship. We have a happy relationship. We like each other. We love each other. We want to be together the rest of our lives. We like the roles that are complementary. And we want to have the role socially. We want to be recognized by the society as a couple. We want to have that place in society. And the place of husband and wife is different in society. It has more social value than the place of cohabiting partners. Society takes married people more seriously than it takes cohabiting partners. It gives you more legal right. It counts you differently. Society counts you differently. You want other people to know that you are not fair game. Okay? I want to be married, and I want you to wear a ring so that when you, even if you are sitting by yourself at the bar, anybody who's hitting on you knows that you are married. There is somebody out there who may slit their throats if they hit on you too much. I used to have a woman who cut my hair who was just a wonderful, colorful woman. I liked her very much. I liked the way she cut my hair. She got married, had kids, moved away, stopped doing that. I came into the shop one day to get my hair cut, and she had some bruises. And because my concern was that her husband, boyfriend at that time, was not treating her well, and she said, no, just, you know, we were down at whatever the bar was, and this, can I quote her directly? This skaggy bitch was hitting on my boyfriend, and she didn't stop when I told her to, and she continued, and he told her to, and she continued, so we had a cat fight. And I said, ooh. And she said, yeah, but you should see her. And this is a woman I would not have wanted to have a catfight with. So, you want the other relationships, everybody else in society, to know that you are a couple and that you're committed to each other. And you want that ring not to come off. There's probably nothing funnier in the world than going to a bar and watching people hit on each other when one of them has a white band where the ring was before he or she took it off. They've been out in the sun and the tan line doesn't. They take the ring off, but it's still there on the skin, and you know they're cheating. You want, when you marry, first of all, I would want you to know what the legal rights and responsibilities are and what the obligations are. This is something that most of us do not know. Nobody tells us. You didn't have a course in some. Anybody have a course in high school that explained the rights and obligations of marriage legally? Did your premarital education, Colleen, tell you what the legal rights? No, mine either. I had this priest who told me a lot about alcohol and how alcohol abuse was not good for... Anyway, I don't know what his background was. He was Irish. I would like, when you get your marriage license, I would like for you to have a handout. And I'm proposing to help develop it. I need a lawyer to help me. A handout that lists, in Vermont, the legal changes that take place in your relationship when you marry. and what the implications of those are. There are several hundred changes in your status when you marry. The biggies are that you have the obligation to pay each other's debts. If one of you has a credit card in his or her own name, the married partner is obligated to pay it if you default. It affects both credit ratings. If one of you racks up a big balance, it affects your credit rating as a couple. No matter what your partner says, don't worry about it, it won't affect your credit. It will. You won't be able to buy a house because one of you spent too much money. Myla. Yep.
Are you serious?
Yes. I am serious. Yep. So if you have a bad credit report, you marry to improve it, but your partner needs to know that your partner's is going down. Okay? Because you are married. You have the obligation to pay each other's debts, and if one of you owes a lot of money, like student loans, you are obligated. Even though, and now, wait a minute, let me put a caveat out here. I am not an attorney. So anything I say could be completely wrong. Okay, I'm giving you the best of my understanding. You have the obligation to support each other. If you are married for 10 years or more and divorce, you have the right to your former to collect Social Security pension on your former spouse's account if that would give you more money than your own account would. You have that option. And if you do that, your former spouse's Social Security income is dropped. You need to know that when you divorce. After 10 years, it's forever. Even if it's 30 years later when you retire, or she retires, or he retires, you get your choice of which account you want your benefits based on. Credit contracts, debts, insurance, pensions, inheritance, we'll talk a little bit more about those. And then what I'd like to ask you to think about for Monday is, when you get married, what do you have to do? What do you have to do when you get married? And we'll start there.